From the St. Louis Public Radio Community Room at Grand Center, welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The name Leonard Slatkin holds a special place in St. Louis. He is a longtime music director of the St. Louis Symphony, and even though today he is music director with the Detroit Symphony, he remains the St. Louis Symphony's conductor laureate, as well as an internationally acclaimed conductor and baseball Cardinals superfan. We welcome him home. He'll be conducting at Powell Hall this Friday and Saturday, but he's here with us now and will spend the next hour talking about his life before, during, and after his time with our symphony, all of which is detailed in his new book, Conducting Business, Unveiling the Mystery Behind the Maestro. Ladies and gentlemen, Maestro Leonard Slatkin. We welcome you home. And you're the globetrotter of the world these days. I just wonder how in the world you had time to write this book.
That's what the long airplane trips are for. It's also what room service is for. Instead of having to go out to the restaurant, you're sitting at your computer, you're writing away, you're doing research, and you're eating club sandwich at the same time.
Who did you write it for?
It's written primarily for music lovers. It's not a book just for musicians. In other words, if you have some interest in what the field of music is like, then you'll enjoy the book. So the technical aspects are not so demanding of the reader, but a little bit of knowledge helps.
You called your profession misunderstood. What do you mean by that?
Most people see the conductor basically come out, take a bow, turn around, wave the arms, and the sound comes out. But all the matters that go into this are really what the conducting profession is about. It's about how do we study? What makes us go into the profession in the first place? What's the role of a music director? Being a guest conductor, being on the road, working through health issues, which affect many, many conductors. How do you deal with labor strife as it comes up? What's recording like? All these things are really, and I don't believe really have ever been discussed by an active conductor. Mostly they're done by academics. So this book is somewhat unique.
Speaking of health issues, how is yours?
Mine is good right now. I had a little setback about 3.5 years ago. I was conducting in Rotterdam, and in the middle of the Rachmaninoff Second Symphony, I didn't feel so good. But the show must go on. I finished the piece, and then the medical team said, "You're having a heart attack. An ambulance is on the way. You'll be fine." And sure enough, I was fine, and I am now.
And you look great.
I feel good.
Welcome home. I can't say that
Thank
enough.
You.
So many people are so familiar with the work that of your time here in St. Louis and have followed that career very closely. I read your book, and I enjoyed it immensely, even though this is not my world. It's certainly is yours. But one of the things, the questions that arose early on, as you speak of growing up in the household with your mother and father, musicians who were as comfortable working a Hollywood soundstage as they were performing chamber music, young Leonard Slatkin probably could have gone in a couple of different directions. I mean, Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., Nat King Cole were frequent guests at your home. Was there a moment, a time when you decided rather than go in the popular music direction, you would go in the direction you took?
It's a very complicated question. One of the great things about growing up the way I did was that there were no boundaries. We had no issues with genres of music, as Duke Ellington said, there are only two kinds of music. There's good music and there's the other stuff. So I grew up with this understanding that within each style, there is good and there is bad. I never thought about classical versus anything else. I was equally comfortable with jazz and blues and folk, whatever it happened to be. The only time I actually can remember not liking something had to do with country music. It changed. In my lifetime, I did hear great country music from out in the West Coast, some like Spade Cooley and others like that. But then it began to change and it lost me. So the first thing was that there was no discrimination in terms of sound. In our household, we could listen to Beatles as well as Beethoven. There was really not a turning point so much for me, but sadly, my dad died when he was only 47. I was 19. And for about a year, year and a half, I left music altogether, not knowing what to do. I'd been a pianist, I played violin, I played viola, I composed, and nothing seemed to fit. So my dad passes away, And gradually people began to encourage me to get back into music. My father was also, in addition to being a great violinist and an arranger, he was a fine conductor. But there was a lot of tension in the household and a lot of competition. Getting out of music seemed like the right thing to do. And then when I returned, as harsh as it sounds, I realized that a door had opened. I could actually go into conducting because my father was no longer there. I know it sounds harsh, but it's the way it was. So I pursued that path, and to some degree, today I'm probably doing what he would have liked to do.
Do you feel that even following his passing that there was a sense of competition with your parents?
Sure. For so many years. Oh, it's Leonard. He's the son of Felix, or the son of Eleanor. And then, after the St. Louis time, at least at the point, about the midway point of my music directorship here, when my mother would come in, she would be proud because, oh, you're Leonard's mother. And then all the recordings from their string quartet got reissued and received incredible plaudits and awards. And once again, I was Felix and Eleanor's son, but this time I was proud of it.
Your exposure to some of the names that I mentioned before, some of those in the popular idiom, how did that impact you in terms of your show business presence? Because you certainly have a show biz presence.
Actually, very little. Where the possible interest in communicating with people and doing media and all that came was from right here in St. Louis. There was a time when I first showed up as the assistant conductor in 1964. The orchestra was on strike, not because I was the assistant conductor, I don't think. But during that time, I think it was 6 or 7 weeks long, I was invited to do an interview at what was called then KDNA. It was a radio station in Gaslight Square. It existed in a house. Most of the people lived in that house, and the station went on the air simply when somebody got up and turned the transmitter on. So I did an interview, and they asked me if I wanted to do a radio show. You have to understand, at that time, I was very shy, and I wasn't comfortable speaking to people, and one-on-one was okay, but any more than that wasn't so good. But I thought maybe if I tried radio, sitting alone in a room, spinning records, talking, and just listening to myself, that I could learn something. And that's really where it came from. But, of course, being comfortable with people like Sinatra, Nat King Cole, June Christie, Julie London, all these kind of people, made it a little easier when it came to communicating to other important personalities.
So your book also had a myth-busting quality to it in a couple of different areas, one of which concerned Frank Sinatra and Nelson Riddle. Riddle, his conductor-arranger on most of the albums he did for Capitol, I guess, but it wasn't always Nelson Riddle.
No, what happened was that Nelson was a great arranger. Sinatra always surrounded himself with great arrangers, whether it was Gordon Jenkins, Nelson, Billy May, whoever it was. And Frank always acknowledged his arrangers. That was, to him, the meat of his success. But Nelson really was not a very good conductor. They would maybe get 2 songs done per session. Sinatra wanted to move a little more quickly. He was finicky, but he didn't like to be slowed down. So Capitol Records would often arrange for Nelson to go out of town, sometimes conducting on tours with Nat King Cole. And the conductor on many of these albums is my dad. So arranged by Nelson Riddle, yes. Conducted by, not always.
What makes a good conductor? If Riddle was not one, what makes a good one?
Well, a lot of it is communication. The ability to look at your musicians, interpret what's on the page of music, and get that information out to the musicians in an efficient way. That's one thing. The second thing is, there needs to be a certain command of the technical skills. That would be in any profession. You wouldn't ask a violinist to just show up and not be able to get around the instrument comfortably. A conductor has the same kind of skill sets. It needs to be clear to the members of the orchestra. It needs to convey itself to the audience as well. That part, of course, you can't describe, and you can't teach it. Either you have it or you don't. And we can never know what makes a great conductor. You can ask any orchestra player, why is this one better than the others? They'll give you some technical answers. But the bottom line is, no one really knows. It's that sort of magic that goes on between a conductor and another person. And the interesting thing about that is,
that often a conductor who's good in one place isn't so good in another. I went one time to the Concertgebouw Orchestra in Amsterdam, one of the great orchestras of the world, and it wasn't a particularly good relationship the first time out. It just didn't click. I was asked back 20 years later, and we had a terrific time. I changed, they changed, who knows? But it went very well. And now I don't see them much anymore. Who knows?
What is left for interpretation? Now, I'm the novice, the outsider looking in. You've got the notes are there, the tempo is there, everything is there. What's to interpret?
With new music, not a lot, because the composers are now so accurate in what they want. The matter of interpretation itself is secondary. But when you start talking about the music pre-1960 or so, there are different approaches to the music. It can have to do with things being faster or slower, louder or softer, shorter or longer. The spaciousness or the compactness of a piece of music. It's maybe better to say, supposing we had a Shakespeare work in front of us, and each of you sitting here or listening at home was going to direct a Shakespeare play. Each of you would come up with a different idea about how it should look and how it should sound. Essentially, the conductor looks at a score and translates it in the way you would translate a language. Music is just a language. We just have circles and dots and dashes, and we translate that into sound. So each of us comes up with our way of trying to imagine what the composer may have intended. That raises another issue for all musicians. Can we really replicate what the composer meant? And the answer is no, we can't, because one, they're not here to discuss it. Times have changed. Orchestras now play in halls that are much larger. The public does not arrive at a concert by horse carriage, and we don't play by candlelight. We progress, we move forward. What we try to do is to convey what the composer wanted, what we believe they wanted, and how it might be now in the 21st century. What would be different? Anybody, though, who goes out and tries to play something just for the sake of being different is missing the boat altogether.
You're listening to Maestro Leonard Slatkin, who is in St. Louis this week, and we're very happy to have him with us on St. Louis on the Air. I'll tell our audience at home that we can take questions via email. That's at talk@stlpublicradio.org. You can send us a tweet at STL on Air or reach us through Facebook. We'll be back to continue our conversation with the maestro in just a moment, and we'll be taking questions from our studio audience as well. Back with Leonard Slatkin in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. Welcome back to our conversation with Maestro Leonard Slatkin of the Detroit Symphony, formerly, of course, with the St. Louis Symphony. And Maestro, picking up on the conversation where we departed a moment ago, if you were conducting, and once you've found what you want to do with, let's say, Respighi's Pines of Rome, is it going to be the same way the next time you do it, and the time after that, and
the time after that? I think for me, the joy and the beauty of music making has to do with the spontaneity. Essentially, what we do is we use our rehearsal time in the same way that a coach of a football or baseball team would. We practice, we work out the plays, we work out the signs, we do what we can. But then when it comes to game time, there are matters that you have to improvise because you just don't know what kind of conditions you're going to encounter. Somebody in the orchestra may have had a bad cheese sandwich, and that affects how some other people react. Somebody could have a crisis at home. That affects things. The conductor themselves might have a different feeling and sense of rhythm, tempo, speed, all these things affect it. So for me, it's work time at rehearsals and play time at concerts.
Well, you talk about innovating. You've got 100 people that are watching your every move, and they have to kind of certainly plug into whatever this innovation is.
Well, somebody has to be the leader. One person has to say, this is the way it's going to go. Not everybody will agree, but for the moment, everybody has to be on the same page, or at least you hope they will. And a good performance is one where you feel a unanimity of thought on the stage. For me, a great performance is one where I feel that the performers are interacting with each other, and I'm just there kind of helping out. When you watch me conduct, if you see me beating very small gestures, or not at all, that means it's really going well because I don't have to do too much.
Right. And that's good for you.
It's very good for me.
I suppose.
I get paid even if I get beat small.
You made a point in the book about talking about the size of the baton. That's something someone like I would never have thought of, but it's an important aspect.
Well, a baton is nothing more than an extension of the hand. And when you conduct, the baton needs to direct the attention to the palm of the hand. It's a little hard to describe it on the radio. Frequently, I will drop the stick altogether and not use it. That has to do more with getting rid of the angularity of the stick. The stick provides beats and gestures that can only be perceived as being harsh. 1, 2, 3, 4, like a square. It's hard to make a circle with a stick. So often I'll put it down if I'm looking for something a little more rounded in sonority.
We have members of our audience here who want to get into this conversation because we have many questions. Let's get them in right away. It's Barbara L., is that correct?
Correct.
Go ahead, please, with your question.
I would like to, before the question, just say there are several of us here in the audience who were lucky enough to play under Leonard Slatkin. And what he does is he enables you to play better than you think you can. And that always came through in concerts. And
I thank you so much.
But my main question was, would you describe your family's escape from Las Vegas?
Yes. Well, my father was a compulsive gambler. And in the late 1930s, he bought a new violin. Well, he bought an old violin, but it was an expensive violin, a Guadagnini. And it was Friday, so the studio sessions had finished at both Fox and Warner's, where my parents worked. And my dad said, let's get in the car. We'll go to Las Vegas. My mother hopped in. Back then, it was about a 6.5-hour drive, maybe 7 hours. And they arrived, 2 a.m, and my dad went immediately to the craps tables, which is what he played. After 15 minutes, he was down $2,000. We were not particularly affluent at the time. And my mother said, Felix, we have to go. This is not good at all. And he said, no, I know something's going to turn. And my mother said, look, it's up to you, but you just bought an expensive violin. We have to be able to pay for it. He said, I know I'm going to win enough to cover that fiddle. And my mother said, I don't think so. So you just, my father said, you just go to the room. I'll be back. About 3 a.m, Felix Slatkin gets back to the room looking despondent. And he says, come on, Eleanor, we'll go home. They put the luggage in the car, drove the 6.5-7 hours back, not a word spoken in the car, got back to L.A. about 10 a.m. My mother finally said, I think we should talk about this. What are we going to do now? Felix said, I don't know. Let's just get some rest, unpack the bags. We'll talk about it when we wake up. My mother opened the bag, and there was $25,000 in it. Then she didn't talk to him for a week. It certainly didn't always work out that way.
The world has changed, obviously, and unions have had a great deal
yes.
to do with that. What is the impact? You mentioned a strike a little while ago. We've undergone work stoppages here in St. Louis. What impact overall has the labor movement had on music?
Well, for the most part, it's been a very positive impact. Musicians were very much on the low rung of the totem pole when it came to wages. It's a very specialized skill. Not many people can do what orchestral musicians do. And when you look at the wages as they were, say, in the 1950s, compared to what they are now, the jump is huge, 25, 30 times more. Seasons are longer, orchestras are thriving, but many orchestras in this country are not. As we're speaking, we see the orchestras in Minnesota and St. Paul locked out. Bitter disputes in Indianapolis, Atlanta, Jacksonville, all over. My orchestra in Detroit was on strike for 6 months, and we settled. But fortunately, in Detroit, we came away with a plan to recover after the strike. And I would say that today we're doing quite well. Nobody thought we would be this far along. How much this has to do with the unions, I'm not sure. One can argue back and forth about what's been beneficial and what hasn't. One thing that can't be argued is that the wages of high-ranking symphony orchestras probably go slightly out of the province of the regular labor movement. For me, the unions provide wonderful resource for people doing the record dates, the clubs, things like that. But I think when it comes to orchestras, we sort of operate on our own. We're independent of the unions themselves in that way. So I don't really know. And I think we'll probably see a change over the next 5-10 years in how the labor movement affects orchestras.
Well, it affects in many ways, not the least of which is it's very clearly prescribed as to how long you will rehearse,
yeah.
Various things as labor contracts tend to do. There are times, I'm sure, when you'd like to rehearse another half hour, as you point out in your book, you can't do it.
No, and I think some of the things are a little bit restrictive. Maybe it will change, and each individual orchestra does have the chance to do that. One thing that, for instance, always bothers me with some orchestras is that you're supposed to rehearse from the largest-sized orchestra down to the small, meaning if you start with a big piece, you end with the smaller-sized orchestra, which might be a piece by Mozart or Haydn, which could be the most difficult on the program when you don't want your musicians tired at the end of the day. There are days I'd rather start with that piece, but some orchestras don't permit that. There are small changes like that that I'd like to see occur.
Back to the audience, and Jerry C. joins us. Go ahead, Jerry.
Good morning. I'm just commenting on your earlier statement about no one really knows what makes a great conductor, and the people whose work I most admire tend to fall into the category of either film director or, as a jazz fan, longtime mm-hmm. successful jazz band leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And I really find in all the studying, reading, et cetera, listening I've done, no one can really tell you why certain directors can elicit a better performance from the same actor that others can. I mean, you're dealing with a group of creative individuals, and the ability to mold that into a motion picture or a particular sound, such as the greats like Duke Ellington, mm-hmm. Count Basie, mm-hmm. Stan Kenton did, I find to be endlessly fascinating. But like you say, I think at the end of the day, there is no, it's not a teachable skill.
That's right. Actually, as you mentioned it, I've been listening recently to a lot of Stan Kenton. I've been listening to a lot of the West Coast jazz people. Shorty Rogers was phenomenal. And you wonder, what made this? And I knew these people.
Lenny Niehaus is another.
I mean, just on and on. But the point is that we can't really put into words what made them unique. Some were soft-spoken. Some were way out there and progressive. But I guess it's something in the chemistry, something in their makeup that provides a sense of leadership. Maybe leadership is the key here. Leadership styles are defined in so many different ways. So each person finds their own way to do it. And when you start comparing band directors, film directors, symphony conductors, probably it's the difference in their style that makes them interesting, that they're not really like anybody else. You can't compare Bernstein, say, to George Sell, to Fritz Reiner. And you can't compare Kenton to Gil Evans or any of those people. They're all different. And maybe it's the difference that makes the difference here.
Some people may have recognized the voice of Jerry C. That's yeah. Jerry from O'Fallon. For regular listeners to this program, he calls quite a bit. You mentioned Bernstein, and you spend some time in your book talking about your relationship. Give us, our audience, some sense of what that was.
A lot of people thought I knew Bernstein all my life, and I didn't. I only got to know him about 5 years before he died. I met him at Tanglewood. I was supposed to meet him a couple times before, but things always went in the wrong direction. He was conducting the Vienna Philharmonic in Chicago. We were supposed to go to dinner afterwards. And that night, while he was shaking hands with the members of the orchestra, he fell off the podium and injured himself and went to the hospital. So I didn't meet him there. But finally at Tanglewood, I had the chance. And we became good friends over the course of the few years that he had left. He was a very complicated man. But without Bernstein, conductors like me couldn't exist. He paved the way. He was the first American to really show us that Americans could succeed as conductors. Up until Bernstein, there really weren't any prominent ones at all. He was a remarkable man, and he wanted to be remembered most of all as a composer, but not as a composer of West Side Story, mm-hmm. a composer of the symphonies and the ballets. I don't know if that will ever happen because West Side Story is such a work of genius, incomparable. But nonetheless, I continue to play as much of his music as I can.
He brought his world to the world, and certainly here in the United States, through television.
Right.
Which basically is the way kind of you got started with
yeah.
the radio,
that's right.
giving that exposure.
Yeah, he showed us that it was important to communicate to our audiences in ways other than just waving a stick to the orchestra.
We have a Facebook comment here from Peter who says, how can we get radio to be innovative again? I would love to hear DJs be as creative as Slatkin with his shows as a young adult.
Well, thank you. I think that if you search on the internet long enough, you're going to find a lot of creativity out there. If you go to something like Pandora, you become your own DJ. But I think we're looking for people who have novel and unusual ways of putting music and words together. I don't know. I think the future of radio is fascinating because if we go back 10 years, everybody thought this medium was dead. Nobody thought radio would exist in the 21st century. And yet there's more available on the global airwaves than there's ever been. So there's more now than I can ever remember. You just have to take advantage of it. And you're right. DJs, as we used to call them, remember that was the time when you were supposed to play the records and not scratch them?
Mm-hmm.
That was a different time altogether. And maybe we need to have more knowledgeable people, just as we should in the few remaining record stores that there are. I used to go to buy records, and there's a great story, by the way. The first recordings we made here in St. Louis were for Vox Records, which was the first budget label. And the head of Vox was a guy named George Mendelssohn, who was a direct descendant of the composer Felix Mendelssohn. One of the conductors on the Vox label was the conductor Otto Klemperer, who was music director in Los Angeles at the time. Well, Klemperer wanted to go to a record store and see how his records were being promoted. So they went to Wallach's Music City, it was on Sunset and Vine, and they walked in and they went up to the salesperson and said, we'd like to have the Klemperer version of the 7th Beethoven Symphony. And the salesperson says, no, no, you don't want that. It's too slow. you should get the Toscanini. It has much more vibrancy. No, no, no. We must have the Klemperer. He says, why would you want that when Toscanini exists? And George says, you don't seem to understand. This is Maestro Klemperer. And the salesperson says, yeah, and I'm sure you're Beethoven. He says, no, I'm Mendelssohn.
Let's bring in Nancy Z. Nancy Z, go ahead, please.
Hi, you were talking earlier about the differences between classic and modern composers, and I just wondered which you preferred conducting.
I'm fortunately at the point in my life when I really only conduct composers that I like. There's not a preference here. The program we're playing this week has three pieces I love, two of them written in the 20th century, one in the 21st, one by my wife, Cindy McTee, double play. The baseball reference is intentional. And Stravinsky's Symphony of Psalms, written for the Boston Symphony, and Holst's Planets. So really, I'm at the point now where I just don't do music that I don't enjoy. When I was the assistant conductor here, I did everything. Mostly for the experience. You want to conduct as much as possible to determine what you will like and what you won't. Fortunately, my repertoire is quite large, and there are only a few handfuls of styles and pieces where I'm not comfortable. It's not that it's not great music. I just know I don't do it very well, and it's better for others. It's really, if you ever see Bruckner and Slatkin in the same sentence, don't go. Although I might try it again someday. It's just I'm not good at it. Other people are.
All righty, let's bring in Bob H.
Well, I guess my question is really a follow-on to that one is, is there a favorite composer that you have that you really enjoy conducting more often than any other, maybe?
Usually the piece I'm conducting at the time qualifies. I think it's easier for me to say that there are pieces that I couldn't do without. Not one, certainly. And most of the ones I can't do without are not ones I would conduct. The late quartets of Beethoven, or the Schubert double cello quintet, or the Goldberg variations, works in the chamber or solo field. Orchestrally, next month in Detroit, we'll embark on a 3-week survey of the 9 Beethoven symphonies. How can anybody, one, compare them and say one is better than the other? And just doing the cycle itself is enough of a challenge. So I would say that anybody coming to a Slatkin concert is probably 95% assured that I love all those musics that I'm conducting.
Thank you, Bob. Leonard Slatkin, you say in your book that nothing in modern media reproduction can replace live performance.
No.
Interesting comment given in this digital age when so much is changing. So many people depend on that for their music intake.
I'm reminded of a routine done by the satirist and humorist Lewis Black. I will refrain from using the words he uses. But he did a bit about the time when MTV took over the Super Bowl halftime. And he said, in essence, that we needed to remember that music is for the ear. And, of course, MTV is for the eye. If you're traveling and you listen to a song or a piece of music, and it has some relevance to something that happened in your life, it could be a tragedy, it could be something wonderful, your mind should go to that piece of music. It should not flash to the video of that piece of music, because that's other people telling you what to think, what to see, what to have in your head. If there's one quality that we're in danger of losing in our society today, it's the world of imagination, because we're constantly told what it looks like and what it sounds like. So if I was a music producer for videos, I would love to have three or four different versions of the same song, just to give people a choice. And for concerts, I'm not a big fan of these additional things like screens with videos and all this stuff. I think there needs to be a challenge to the audience. You need to use your intellect. You need to use your imagination. If there are 2,000 people at a concert, there should be 2,000 different responses.
You are listening to Maestro Leonard Slatkin on St. Louis on the Air. We are broadcasting from the community room at our Grand Center offices, and we'll be back to continue our conversation with the maestro in just a moment. We'll be taking questions from our audience. For those of you at home, send us an email if you like at stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on Air, or you can also reach us through Facebook. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. Welcome back as we continue our conversation with Maestro Leonard Slatkin. And Maestro, we have an email from Mary. You just answered part of what she was asking.
Right.
She said, I am conducting the Planets with the St. Charles Community College Orchestra in the spring. Any general suggestions or specific issues I should be aware of as a director? Also, do you think it would detract from my music to have a visual presentation to accompany the performance? I think you might have just answered that.
On the other hand, to be devil's advocate, sometimes the visual helps draw in your audience. I would say, Mary, two things. First of all, if you have decent-sized audiences, don't worry about the visuals. Don't do them. If you need to attract an audience with it, fine, but keep it minimal. Don't let it get in the way of the music. And remember, the Planets is not about the physical planets. It's about the astrological planets. It's very different. As far as the technical advice in conducting the work, think of the first four movements as being a symphony with a first movement, a slow movement, a scherzo, and a finale. Then link the remaining three. So you think of this piece as one symphony, plus then three movements that go kind of connected, because they work harmonically. As far as the ending goes, the best thing to do is to have the chorus off stage and then have them walk as they're singing and gradually close their mouths until the piece fades away.
Good advice, Mary. I hope you're listening. I hope you're listening. Let's take this next question. It's from Elizabeth L. Go ahead, please.
Would you like to give an assessment of the musicians from your day in the symphony as compared to the musicians today?
In St. Louis Symphony?
Yes.
I haven't started rehearsing yet, so that's a little tricky. But on the other hand, I think there are probably about 25 or so left from my days. Not very many from when I started. It was always a fine orchestra. You know, if you go back to the time of Vladimir Goldschmann right through the time of Suskin, Semkov, Vonk, now David Robertson, this is really been a phenomenally important orchestra in this country. Nothing pleases me more than to know that the legacy or whatever it is that I left while I was here, is continuing. The orchestra continues to have fantastic press. It does very well when it's on tour, and it's regarded very highly nationwide. Any great orchestra is going to have its own personality, and St. Louis remains a good destination spot for young musicians as well as experienced ones to come. So I think they're in very good shape. I'll determine for myself how different it is. It has to be a little different because there are so many new players in the orchestra. But I'm excited to come back. Maybe I think the old players will say, see, that's what we had when we were here. And the young ones will go, no big deal.
You talked earlier about how some orchestras seem to be languishing at this particular time. Obviously, audiences need to be built for all of these orchestras. How do we do that? How do you bring the younger audience to the symphony?
Every community is different. The problems of one place do not necessarily reflect the problems of another. So I can only tell you what we did in Detroit. We were in really bad shape with audiences, both age-wise and in numbers. What we wound up doing was to create something called the sound card. For $25 at the beginning of the season, if you're a student, you buy this card. 2 weeks before any performance, if there are seats available, present the card, you're in. That's $25 for the whole year. And people said, well, that doesn't make any economic sense. And I said, sure it does. Those seats are empty otherwise. Now we see between 90 to 95% houses on every concert we do. Another thing we do in Detroit is all of our subscription concerts are streamed video on the internet. So we're creating a new audience. The definition of audience has changed. It's not just the people in the seats. It's a global audience, people listening to us worldwide. We've had occasions where we know we've had 130,000 viewers worldwide. So we've done that. We've gone out in the community. We now play in six suburban locations to reach those people who either don't want to come to downtown or are too infirm or age-wise just don't feel like coming down. All those series are sold out. Every community needs to find its own way to attract the kind of audience it believes it should have. That being said, we always have to remember that what we do as a symphony orchestra is for a very specialized audience. It's only about 5, maybe 6% of a given population. We have to make sure we reach that population, but at the same time, make the image of the orchestra known to the rest of the community. Here in St. Louis, for example, everybody knows about the baseball team. People who hate baseball know about the baseball team. You have to put the orchestra in the same position. People go, I'd never go to the symphony, but I know they're doing a good job. That's exactly what you want. And then maybe they will come to the orchestra. In Detroit, we also did a concert last year with Kid Rock. Raised $1 million. Sold out in 2 hours. We'll do this annually. Those kind of things help us to attract a new audience, but only for the specific events. We're not thinking if these are going to become subscribers in the future. It's really just about awareness, what they call, I guess, product placement and branding.
But, you know, kids are playing baseball when they're 4 and 5 years old. Do you have concerns about the fact that music education in our schools has really taken a back seat? No child left behind, teaching to the test, music is out of here.
Well, when I got to Detroit, I met the head of the public school system who bragged that 30% of Detroit public school students were receiving music education, and I said that means 70% aren't. So one thing we've done is to create music programs in schools where there aren't any. The symphony now pays its members extra fees to do work within the community. We teach people about public speaking. We do so many educational events now. These are all part of the new way we have to think. And every orchestra will have to come up with its own solution. You're absolutely right. Education in music has gone off the map here. And it's a shame because the arts are such an integral part of culture and society. When you see those elements disappear from a young person's upbringing, you really are looking at potentially the decline of a society.
You raise in the book, and I don't believe it was your idea specifically, although you do seem to endorse it, the community of musicians idea. Explain that.
Well, that's really what we're talking about here. So supposing you have an orchestra of 100 people. Not all your programs are going to use 100 musicians. You can do a Mozart program, Schubert, Bach, whatever. So what do we do with the musicians who are not playing in a given week? Well, they can have some vacation. But more to the point, I think, is to utilize the talents of those musicians. Maybe some would like to do contemporary music, playing in universities, playing in clubs. Others would like to do early music and period performance. That's possible. Others would do teaching. Maybe another would go out and do work with community ensembles, all those kind of things. Occasionally, you bring the full forces together for concerts. You spread them all out over the city. And I think that's the way to go for many, many orchestras now.
Really an outreach program.
Yes.
Let's bring in Joyce P. in our audience. Go ahead, Joyce.
Thank you. A perfect segue, because I wanted to thank you, Mr. Slatkin, for leaving us with the legacy of the youth orchestra program that we have here. It's fantastic. I have two children who played in it, and they are now playing in their college orchestras of Brown University and University
That's
of
great.
Vermont. I understand that when you started the youth orchestra, your stipulation was that children had to also play in their school orchestra or band programs. My question is, did you intend for the kids to play the same instrument in their school program or simply to participate? And I ask this because I have a daughter in ninth grade who was not able to participate in her young people's orchestra because she wanted to play band and flute in her school program.
Yeah, I think what I said was they had to participate in the school's music program, not the orchestra program.
That's my interpretation. However, I was not told that that would be...
No. She should, if she's in the music program, she should be allowed, certainly.
Great. I hope.
And just because you play in a band, that's these days, bands are fantastic. The repertoire they have is amazing. The degree of... I just conducted in Chicago something called the Midwest Clinic, which is for... 20,000 people show up for this thing, and there are band directors and musicians from all over, and the level is so high. It is amazing. So if there's a restriction here, you should fight very hard to say music is music. Doesn't matter if it's a band, an orchestra, a chorus, or handbells.
I agree with you 100%. Thank you.
Thank you, Joyce. We have an email question from Bob. Did I see you at the Mahavishnu Orchestra concert in the mid-70s?
Yes, you did.
Under the tent at the Mississippi River Festival. What did you think of the musicianship?
Mahavishnu Orchestra, in my DJ years, I played them all the time. That was with John McLaughlin and Billy Cobham. It was a highly progressive sort of fusion of rock and jazz at the time. You could never quite figure out what their rhythmic basis was. It was amazing. In fact, there were a lot of groups like that where the musicianship was of such high quality. You look at Emerson, Lake and Palmer, Yes, other things like that. I love this music. I love the experimentation of people who came and stretched boundaries at the time. So, yep, you saw me at the Mahavishnus. It was great. And I got to know John McLaughlin pretty well.
That was a great program, that Mississippi River Festival.
Oh, it was.
That was
we had a lot of fun, especially when the tornado hit. Leonard Rose was hiding under the trailers with his cello. That was nice.
I saw Johnny Mathis there, and a mosquito flew into his mouth when he was singing. It was 15 minutes of him trying to get that mosquito out of his, away from his vocal cords. Anyway, that's another story.
Did he sound better? Did he sound better because of it?
He might have gone up a couple of octaves.
I don't know how.
Let's take Richard's question. Go ahead.
Yes, I have very fond memories of your days at KDNA.
Thank you.
And I wanted you to tell the story about the night you were on the air and your car was...
Oh! I used to do this show on Thursdays. It was called, rather non-egotistically, The Slatkin Project. It was 4 hours live on Thursday. I used Terry Riley's Rainbow and Curved Air as the theme. But once a month, I would do the overnight shift. I loved doing it. It was great fun. You could just say, now... to say Matthew Passion, and you put it on, and 2 hours later, you know, you take a nap or whatever you wanted to do. And one night, it was in Gaslight Square, as I mentioned, and one night I came out at 6 in the morning, and my car was gone. It had been stolen, and I think it only went about 2 blocks before they smashed it into the side of a street of some kind, and it was found again. It was always an adventure there at KDNA. They were raided a few times for illegal substance goings on. I had to testify at a trial once, and they got off. I don't know how they got off, actually, because it was going on. It was a great... One of the great stories from there is the morning guy was named Fritz Reutermann, and he didn't have any knowledge of classical music, but I organized their record library, and one day he put on Beethoven 7, the Toscanini version, and he called me at home. He woke me up, and he said, Beethoven said, this is great. And I said, I'm glad you like it, Fritz. He says, I'm going to play it again. And he did. And then he played it a third time. That's what that station was about. I think our other person who wrote in, that's what we're missing today, the kind of spontaneity in broadcasting that we need to have.
The substances you mentioned are not unknown to some musicians also.
No, in our field.
But I was going to say some of the people perhaps you ran across as a child might have been.
Well, my father used to tell the story about his army days with Dave Brubeck getting caught behind the barracks growing some weed. Uh-huh. There was a sad story about a trumpeter named Conrad Gazzo, who was a phenomenal trumpet player. And he just had a horrible split with his wife, and he walked into a recording session on a Friday, announced, this is my last session, I'm just going to lock myself in my room, and I'm going to drink until I die. And he did. It's terrible.
Terrible story. Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of the things I found interesting in your book was a relatively small portion of it talking about some of the pranks that orchestra members can pull on conductors. Give us some sense of what that part of your life has been like.
One of the favorite ones that I like is when you conduct in England and it's an orchestra that you're seeing for the first time, you start rehearsing, and we have two ways of dealing with the pauses when we have to go and play a piece of music. We either say, let's start at 21, or it's a letter. It's either a number or a letter. So in England, when you do that and you've gone through a certain amount, and you say, everyone, T, they get up and leave. There's lots of little things like that. I don't think we had too many little ones in St. Louis. There's a cute one in Minneapolis they do when one of the brass players drops a mute, all the other brass players grab their mutes and hold it up to prove that they weren't the ones who did it.
Relationship very important, obviously, yes, between the musicians and the conductor. We have a limited time left. I don't have the notes in front of me, but I'm sure you've committed to memory exactly what's happening with you at the Powell on
yes.
Friday and Saturday.
We have concerts on Friday and Saturday. We begin with a piece by my wife, Cindy McTee, called Double Play. It's lyric on one part and then frantic on the other. Great fun to do. We have the Symphony of Psalms by Igor Stravinsky, featuring the St. Louis Symphony Chorus, an organization I helped found. And then after intermission, Gustav Holst's The Planets. And if I get sick, we know there's somebody in town who can conduct now.
Right. I think it was Mary. I hope that she is there. Now, you haven't had an opportunity to perform with the St. Louis Symphony in how long?
I think I was here 3 years ago. Maybe two and a half.
Do you have a sense, of, I guess you do, having done it just a couple of years ago, of what it will be like? I mean, this is a homecoming for you.
It's a homecoming in some ways, and other ways it's not. My life is now centered in Detroit and in Lyon, my other orchestra in France. So coming back and seeing old friends is always wonderful. But when it comes down to it, it's still about making music. And wherever you go, the joy of this process, working with musicians, telling stories even, having some good times. But the focus is on being serious so you present the best product to the audience. You have to remember, you have members of the orchestra and many members of the audience who don't know me. So I have to start all over again.
You have less than a minute left. When you come back to St. Louis, where do you go? Where do you like to go?
Well, good thing about this time of year, I can't go to Ted Drew's.
So, or the baseball game.
Or a baseball game. You can go to Ted Drew's?
Yes, it's open.
It is? Oh, my son's going to be happy. My son was born here in St. Louis. He's now 18, goes to the University of Southern California, but he'll be here Saturday for the show. He hasn't seen me conduct in St. Louis in a long time. And I'm just thrilled to be back and to be with everybody and to be with all of you today.
Maestro Leonard Slatkin, everyone. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Don. Great to see you again, too.
Same here. And we'll look forward to listening to you and watching you later this week at Powell Hall. Leonard Slatkin. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with former Missouri Secretary of State Robin Carnahan and former 3rd District Congressman Russ Carnahan. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. This broadcast of St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer and engineered by Greg Muntinu. The executive producer, Robert Peterson. Thanks also to Mike Schrand, Aaron Williams, Spencer Reed, Rich Herberts, Terrence Dupuy, and Phil Donato for their assistance in today's program. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.